think it's tonight. It's supposed to be Tuesday.
And one of the points that Hegel makes throughout is that at each stage in the unfolding relationship whereby this religious consciousness is going to be aware of the divine as an actual self-consciousness, the various stages in the process which allows this to occur all involve representations. And because they involve representations, the relationships that are, in a sense, conceptually mandated or have a necessary character are presented in a form of representation which involves contents being ascribed to these relationships which have a contingent character, which are not necessitated by the relationships that underlie them. So, you know, one can conceive, for example, of relationships in a, well, we might even almost say a logical sense between how subject and substance could become reconciled with one another and what kind of transformations that would involve, or how universality and individuality would be connected, or how a self-consciousness of spirit could involve a consciousness of something distinct from itself and then be involved in eliminating that distinction, and just think of those issues. But here they're being represented. And because they're being represented, they are being characterized in a way where there are, you could say there's a narrative that involves elements that really can't be conceptually derived. Because they're not just conceptual determinations, or another way of putting it, it involves imagery, and it involves factors that are extraneous to the conceptual relations involved, and thereby necessarily have an element that is contingent and accidental. So I think this indicates that although Hegel is here presenting representations of the relationships at stake, and admittedly, the relationships at stake involve representation, then nevertheless, the particular filling of the representations that you use obviously bears something to do with Christianity, although it's not as if he's exactly naming names or anything of that sort. But nevertheless, there are some major moves being made, and I think it's worthwhile considering what rationale could be given for bringing all of this in. I mean, on the one hand, we have this basic move that distinguishes this form of religion from the others, namely, that the absolute essence is conceived as actual self-consciousness. And then as part of that, there's the recognition that this actual self-consciousness, as actual, has to involve some way of being represented that's going to bring together with its immediate being the element of universality that's attached to it, and the element of absolute character that's attached to it. So, you know, we've seen here various manners of representing the content of which one is conscious. It brings in some aspects of this universal character. But so far, not in a sufficient way. And then it would seem that, well, what gets called for is something akin to what gets represented in the Passion of Christ and the Resurrection. Namely, that this God has to die. Because what does the death of this God do with regard to this actual self-consciousness being something that one can be aware of as being? and absolute essence, in which one is aware of one's own true character. How does the death of this God contribute to that?
I guess it, at least in part, shows that the contingent particular circumstances of this individual incarnation don't matter.
Yeah, I mean, in particular, the particularities of this actual existence are overcome, are negated, so to speak. So at least in that respect, right, you have the obstacle to perceiving here both an actual self-consciousness that is to be something of absolute significance. The discrepancy of its finite being is removed. But also by the same token, the difference between it and me, and you and everyone, is also removed. Because that's another thing. Right? I mean, it is a different human being. You know, being aware of this different human being, we're not necessarily aware of ourselves. Or if we are, we're just maybe, we can be aware of ourselves in the way in which we are aware of ourselves in ethical community with other individuals. But here we're supposed to be dealing with something more than that, yeah.
I mean, so is the point that it just validates our certainty that the being is divine and not just another human being? And so it's not just this immediate intuition that this is a divine and human subconsciousness?
Well, we're operating with the certainty that it is.
Right.
We're construing the divine as being something that is an actual self-conscious. In this case, one possible way of representing it is that we happen to be human beings and we're encountering another human being this way, as opposed to Dr. Spock or whoever might serve the purpose and still be another actual self-consciousness, potentially. But, you know, the death removes the finite individual presence, which both separates this being from ourselves and from the absolute significance it's supposed to have. But you can see that that's not quite enough. I mean, we overcame the same thing in a way with, in a minimal sense, with desire, with appetitive desire, which wanted to remove the difference between the object and me and give me a kind of very ephemeral self-consciousness whereby the otherness of the object is no longer confronting me because I've devoured it. But I'm not conscious of myself as an object anymore, having devoured it. Well, here again, we've removed this particular individual, but that only gets us part of the way. So we need to, in some respect, be able to be conscious of its absolute character. And, you know, that is going to be served through the representation of the resurrection or something akin to that, where it gets united with, let's say, or it becomes revealed to be spirit in the sense of an individuality that is just as much universal and is also absolute, absent spirit. An absent spirit that, in a sense, is what is really essential in reality. And being something in which we can also recognize our own true character. So you have this representation of the resurrection. And then you have something more added to this. Because, you know, you could look at the death as being something that we witness. One witnesses the resurrection. These things now go into the past. Right? But once again, all of this might be said to be suffering the same kind of limitations that was there if we are just sort of representing to ourselves the memory of this incarnation. It's the same sort of thing. So Hegel speaks about something, an additional factor that's brought into play. it's sort of going to take things to the farthest extreme possible, or at least try to push the way of retaining this universality and keeping it there, given the resources of religion. And what is that? What does he invoke? What will he invoke? I'm not saying now because I'm going out of order. I want to go back in a moment. Because remember, he sort of transposes this whole sort of experience of the way in which the divine becomes incarnated, the way in which the incarnation becomes reunited with the divine. Because the incarnation, in a sense, involves it. The finitization, you could say, of the divine. So it also has to have its finitude overcome. Not eliminated, but at some regard, just being an element or a moment of the process within which we have the absolute essence revealed to be spirit, in which we can be self-conscious. I'm referring to what he says about the religious community and how the religious community operates. Because what does the religious community do in this regard? That partly, in a way, is going to, I mean, you still have, right, everything I've just discussed is represented, right? The incarnation, the resurrection, the passion, and so forth is represented. Now, as Hegel points out also in the representation, I mentioned this earlier, the stages along the way are presented in narrative form. They can't help but be there to be represented. And that means, you know, look, this is the character of history. Nothing is necessary. It's contingent. So it's only because Christ resolved to allow himself to be sacrificed and crucified and the like that this happened. Of course, you know, right? He encouraged those who would turn him in, etc. Now that's not necessary, right? There's a sort of a conceptual connection between how this finitization has to be nonetheless, or this particularization, one could say, what is universal has to be brought back in unity and have, you see, the individuality is another way of putting it logically. Right, you can also think of this in terms of the logic of infinity, where you know the divine is not really, or like this way, the infinite is not really infinite if it's external to the finite. Why is that?
It's limited by the finite.
What's that?
It's limited by the finite.
Exactly. It has a boundary on the other side of which is the finite. So it really is a finite infinite. The only way the infinite can really be infinite is if it includes the finite within itself. So in a sense, here we have in religious representation something akin to that, except something more than that, because it's not just that here the divine finitizes itself, but it also becomes a finite self-consciousness. But the further step is a religious community now, in a sense, you could say relives all of this. It relives itself or re-experiences the resurrection and the like through things like communion, right, where one sort of experiences this kind of event and makes it something living within one's own community as a way of doing it. Now, there, you know, we want to think about, well, what are we left with? Because I think Hegel wants to say that here we've sort of pulled out all the stops that are possible to the extent that we remain religious. If we're going to try to construe, well, to be certain of having our own true essence as spirit, in an absolute essence, which requires the absolute essence be, in a sense, what we are. But I want us to think about why he considers this still to be something that has not removed the opposition of consciousness. Because you might regard this as providing us with a self-consciousness of spirit, where the subject is aware of itself as both individual and universal, which is one way of thinking about spirit, by confronting something that it recognizes to be at one with itself. So you might say, okay, have we not now removed the opposition of consciousness? And another side of this is that Hegel will speak about the object as itself being self-conscious. Right? It's self-conscious. It, in other words, knows itself. And you might ask, how does what we have as our object, does the divine know itself? What does it know itself in virtue of what? Let me put it this way, does it know itself as divine through its awareness of the religious community? Or does it have to in order for there to be a kind of equalization? Because one of the guiding points of this whole discussion is that religious experience, religious consciousness always remains employing the form of representation. And the form of representation is based upon the fact that even though we're here dealing with a self-consciousness, and in this case a self-consciousness of the spirit, it's self-conscious of itself by confronting something that cannot be reduced to thinking purely. Even though it's sort of knowing itself in a pure way, it's knowing itself as spirit, really, not in any other capacity. And knowing itself as a spirit that knowing itself is supposed to be at one with what is an absolute spirit. But here, this is occurring in a form in which it requires representation, which means it requires awareness of a content that involves a givenness. It can't be reduced to conceptualization. Now keep that in mind. What I want to go back to are these other sides of the discussion, because Hegel, after having laid out just sort of these basic features of the incarnation is something that is no longer present but past and perceived in these various ways, then speaks about creation, and then speaks about creation of a creation that includes humans, or let's say consciousnesses, finite consciousnesses, who then themselves undergo a transformation from being in a state of innocence to one in which they are aware of the difference between good and evil. And the question, what is the basis for all of this? Because first of all, he introduces it after he's spoken about the incarnation, which seems backwards. Why does that appear to be backwards? I mean, from a conceptual point of view, not just in terms of the narrative of a particular religious text.
I'm afraid my explanation may fall back on the specific religious text, but it's the whole idea that, at least from a Judeo-Christian perspective, the whole reason that you have the incarnation is to overcome the divide that occurs at the point at which people become aware of good and evil. I mean, it's to heal the rift that can be traced back to, to Eden.
You could say that, but also maybe a way that doesn't depend so much on that narrative, but from just something that's sort of built in, one might say conceptually, to what one is dealing with when one deals with incarnation. It would make recourse to creation after that obviously kind of backwards. Well, remember, the incarnation is something in the world. It's the... You could say the humanization or the human actualization of the divine for the religious community, right? So that it presupposes an existing religious community in the world. It presupposes a world and the like. So if you also want to think of this divine as being absolute, because here, since self-consciousness, since reason and so forth, we're dealing with certainties that involve self-consciousness, well, consciousness being certain that what is itself. And if what it is now in unity with an absolute spirit, then that has to be everything, in fact. Or at least everything really is, as opposed to what might be considered illusory. So what I'm getting at is to try to think of, well, why would it be that we might, why this form of religion might be drawn to have a narrative about a creation to begin with. Precisely because, in other words, in order for it to conceive the absolute as an actual self-consciousness, this presupposes there is a nature. But not just that there is a nature, but that the nature has to be created. Now, what kind of argument might underlie that claim to give some rationale to this?
What we created, then the divine and the human being that not created, subconscious would be the gap that would be incapable of being overcome.
But what else? I mean, even if you say the other option is, look, there is a world and there's God. The world is not created. Because that's the other option. Then we could say, well, we'll still have this incarnation of the divine without creation. It's an eternal world, side by side with God. And a God who is not natural in any respect, but is spirit.
Then it would seem that the divine couldn't be natural, couldn't really be incarnate.
Why? Why would that be?
Well, because the world would exist independently of the divine if it's not created. If it is created, then it's...
Well, why would that be a problem if the world existed independently of the divine?
Well, it would be a problem for the notion of incarnation, since the divine is supposed to be a part of the world.
So you're saying, I mean, the problem would be what then? I mean, why couldn't the divine incarnate itself in a world that exists independently of it and independent of its agency?
Well, then the laws and various factors that go into the details of how that incarnation plays out, or the divine would be subject to them, subject to those things, laws of physics and so on. It would make the manifestation of the divine contingent. On the world, on the way the world is, independently of the divine.
I mean, could you say, though, that, certainly there are those who would accept a doctrine of creation, but would say that, look, the created world does have its own laws that haven't been given to it, and yet the divine can do things that in the world is not bound by those laws. Some might argue that, not everyone, obviously. And one of those things might be the conception of Jesus, birth of Jesus, the resurrection of Jesus, things like that, as miracles, as supernatural happenings.
Miracles don't seem impossible, though, if the world is derived from the divine, then why not have miracles? Sure.
And if it isn't, there would be. I mean, if it isn't, what I mean, on the one hand, that might seem to finitize the divine, because then it would be bound by something, right, that is given independently of it, that has a boundary. And the divine in question can't be natural, so it has to be the spirit. So maybe one can, you know, think of it, you know, if we're committed to this idea that the consciousness of religion is only going to come to fruition and be able to, well, it's going to push itself for its own validation to bridge the gap between itself and the divine. It's going to have to conceive the divine as more and more, shall we say, more like spirit, less and less natural. And also, as absolute, it also is not going to be limited by nature. So in this regard, it may have to posit it as, in a sense, an element of itself, as part of its own process of finitization or incarnation, even though it's something that distinguishes it from itself. But anyway, I'm just suggesting these as rationales for why one would bring that in. I mean, clearly the religious consciousness is dealing with the religious community in reference to, in relationship to the divine, and construals of the divine. So there has to be room for the community, its place in the world, and it, a way of relating to the divine that it can be involved in. Now Hegel does, you know, as you know, he speaks about creation, starting with paragraph 769, as being a kind of conceptual imperative in the sense that seems equally to bear upon the idea of incarnation, namely that, you know, we can't have an eternal essence that is abstract, that has no differentiation, that doesn't make itself other than itself. And in this regard, you know, he identifies creation with this process of becoming other. But on that basis, he then moves on to, in a sense, two other relationships. One is to think of the incarnation in a natural way. And what is the natural way? Why is the natural way brought into play? You know, one can quibble with the details, but, you know, it might be that Hegel is suggesting the religious consciousness is going to inevitably give it some kind of natural specification, the process of incarnation. That is to portray it or represent it as a natural occurrence. It can't help but do that. Well, in a sense, why can't it help but do that?
Because it's occurring in nature.
Yeah, it's going to be occurring in nature to begin with. So it has to fit within nature in some respect. But it's not just going to be a natural process, right? It has to be something more than that. So how is this, in a certain respect, exhibited by the particular narrative that he makes use of to illustrate the relation? You know, we're given something that is natural and yet not just natural, but combines the two. Well, let me put it more concretely. On the one hand, Hegel will say that a natural relationship is invoked to speak about the relation of incarnation, namely, you know, we have God presented as, well, father of, which is kind of odd, but if you think about it, but father of the son. Now, of course, it doesn't really matter whether it's whether the incarnation is male, female, hermaphrodite, or whatever. It's just, it's natural, it exists. Now, I mean, literally speaking, okay, you can represent it as a father, but properly speaking, why is that kind of nonsensical? Michelangelo, despite Michelangelo and others.
Just
kind of
finite characterization into the divine.
Yeah, because the divine is spirit, right? It's immaterial. So I don't think you can ascribe a gender to the divine. It just doesn't make sense. In this kind of divine, at least. I mean, the Greek gods, yes, but not to this divine. It has no sexuality. It has no particular bodily identity. So you could speak of it as being the parent in some indefinite sense. And admittedly, if you're dealing with a real individual as the incarnation of God, well, that real individual necessarily is embodied. It has some species being. There are various possibilities of how species reproduce. Right? You could do it sexually, they could do it asexually. But, you know, here we have a combination of the natural and the non-natural. So, the example Hegel gives you have, right? A mother and a father. The father is a divine, but the father is the father only in a way that is, shall we say, in itself. It's not something that is present as an actual natural event. But in addition to this, there is this other story about humans being expelled from the Garden of Eden. Does this have any rationale? Is this really part of the argument? Is there any necessity to this? I mean, granted that there's no way the content of the representations could be necessary in any exhaustive manner. It can't help but be confusion. But is there any rationale for this particular narrative? I mean, if you think of this narrative, what is it, in a way, accounting for this part of, that might be thought of as part of the presentation, part of this religious construal? Or let me put it another way, who is this an account of? Or a representation of?
Jesus the man, I suppose.
I'm wondering, is Jesus the man, or is it
going to confront the world?
Or is it the world of individuals within which this Son of God will be born? And, you know, in some degree, it's an account of, the religious community, how it can be seen to emanate from the divine. You know, you can think of this as also, you know, the narrative is going to be presumably accounting for this other element of the religious experience, which is conscious of itself in relation to the divine, is conscious, as Hegel said earlier, of its unity with the divine, which is going to be directly conscious of in the incarnation. But it's also, right, conscious of itself as a member of the community. So, is there any connection between what goes on in this narrative? What is the crux of this narrative? What is it? What are the terms that come into play? What relevance do they have? Right, there's talk of a move from innocence, which does not involve goodness, to some awareness of the difference between good and evil. And then the question is, how are good and evil characterized? And to what degree does that present something that is has some necessary role to play in what now ensues with incarnation? Thank you. Hegel speaks about good and evil, you know, paragraph 776, 777, actually, well, starting 775, 776, 777. Involves some self-opposition in individuals, where they become aware of some kind of otherness in themselves. Now, why would they need to think of some kind of otherness within themselves as being somehow, you know, an essential part?
After the tragedy?
Yeah, I mean, or, you know, something that's going to be part of their, of who they are as they enter into the relationship with religion. I mean, does it play the role of an enabling condition in some respect? Because certainly, the notions of good and evil are given in a very abstract form. Speaks, you know, in terms of just this kind of disparity within oneself. Some turn inward is involving something. Involving evil. Does that have any resonance with anything we've encountered? I mean, obviously, we came across good and evil in regard to conscience. We had good and bad in other respects, but not good and evil. So is there some resemblance? I mean, what was the distinction of good and evil that we encountered in conscience? And does it really have any bearing upon what's happening here? And remember, that was, you know, that emergence of good and evil and the resolution of good and evil was something that set whole move to religion underway. So is there any connection between that and what's going on here? You know, what was the evil that conscience encountered?
Well, good was what was done with conviction, and evil was whatever opposed that, presumably. But in that case, evil was coming from without. It was what other individuals were doing. And if they were doing it with conviction, then that's what set up that ultimate collapse of consciousness. But here, there's an otherness that's...
But in the sense of what we, I mean, you know, when you speak of it being without, I mean, it's without conviction, in a sense, or independent conviction, was what we count as evil. Now, that could be something, it could be internal, it could be something the individual who's conscientious could do by not being conscientious, first of all, as well as something that another could do. But in some respect, the dividing line between the conscientious and the non-conscientious becomes problematic, since the conscientious is supposed to be both individual and universal. But it can't quite cash itself out as that. And in any event, the evil had involved some opposition to what was universal, what was universally valid. And here too, he speaks about some kind of inward turn away from, well, away from what? I mean, if we put this in some stage with regard to the divine is that to which one has to relate to have one's true essence. It's evil a matter of turning within, away from that, removing oneself from that relationship. Is awareness of good and evil matter of being aware of one's capacity to operate in either direction? Is it, yeah?
Just as simple as awareness of the separation between ourselves and the divine, between finitude and the absolute. I mean, once we recognize that, then we have the minimal basis for making a distinction between good and evil.
But what's the other, I mean, is it just a theoretical matter here? What does it have? I mean, if we're aware of this opposition, does this then create an impetus to, well, act in a certain way, and act in a certain way with regard to the divine? Is this going to provide some kind of subjective precondition for acting with faith, you know, choosing to be good as opposed to evil, committing oneself? I mean, this might be a possibility.
Presumably the religious community is engaged in trying to overcome that divide.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
What does it mean to be acting good and not evil here? Acting in harmony with God, or I'm not sure.
I mean, it's spoken of in terms of just an opposition of being other to oneself, right? Of being other to what one truly is.
Evil is talked about?
Yeah, I mean, the way it's first introduced. I mean, if you look at, you know, 75. And, you know, it's this otherness within oneself. One recognizes it. One's thereby aware of this conflict within oneself, between good and evil. And evil, in some respect, being other to oneself. And presumption, you know, would be that if you're going to speak of your self-identity as being good, there's something universal to your self-identity. You're regarding yourself as an I, that is we, as spirit. You understand yourself to be spirit. And that's, you know, maybe something that here is what's involved in moving from the state of innocence to the state where you can recognize this possible disparity. Since you're not entering the normative domain unless you can regard yourself and, shall we say, have a self-conception that involves universality or an ideal, if you will.
Why don't you have a conception of yourself as universally good in that everyone like you experiences this disparity? So that's a kind of universal character that's...
Well, the thing is, what is this? I mean, disparity is... I mean, look, everyone can have the... can, shall we say, have the potential of acting in a deviant way, right? But being deviant is not equivalent to being universal. Unless, as you're pointing out, this is a kind of formal distinction where then it becomes impossible to hold the two apart, right?
Yeah.
Which is, to some degree, what happened with conscience, since there were no externally given standards. Now here too, there may be something very similar that works itself out, because, I mean, Hegel does speak about love in this connection as being something that's going to reconcile differences and overcome differences. And certainly in the narrative of Christianity, I mean, there's an employment of forgiveness in a way that, you know, might be regarded as not that different from how one moves from, you know, the quandaries of conscience to a self-conception as a religious individual having faith. So, you know, I mean, you know, you can think of this perhaps as also having some connection to that emergence, that is, the emergence of entering into a consciously religious attitude. I mean, especially since the question of the knowledge of good and evil, if you think about it, it's not a knowledge of good and evil that's based upon, for example, if you think of the narrative of the Old Testament, of being presented with a tablet with divine commandments. It's a knowledge that one somehow, a knowledge that one sort of has on one's own. It's almost like conscience, really. Right? It's not based upon perceiving any particular laws. We're not yet in Deuteronomy, for example, where the endless law is being presented and perhaps a matter of apprehending them and maybe getting judicial pronouncements upon them. It's something more immediate, subjective. So this may reflect a way of recapitulating something akin to the emergence into over the disconsciousness. In later on in paragraph 780, you know, Hegel does speak about a kind of reconciliation of evil and good. And this is connected to the reconciliation of the divine essence with the other as such, which of course is connected to reincarnation in general and resurrection and the like. So, and you know, perhaps you can see this as sort of another side, that is the way in which there will be a kind of religious reconciliation of good and evil, overcoming their difference or removing the distinction. Bringing into faith something akin to what happened, you know, with the resolution of conscience. Where neither the one nor the other will have truth, it will rather be this process that unites them, that in a way depends upon the divine. And whether that's something like forgiveness in general, that kind of another way of thinking about the reconciliation thing too, with the infinite. And what I want us to conclude with is what is it that the religious community here achieves and what does it not achieve? You know, Hegel in paragraph 784 speaks about the resurrection and how, you know, when you just have the divine man dying, you know, you have just a kind of abstract negativity. You just remove the individuality. You end the natural being. I mean, death is a kind of natural universality. You may remember that Hegel earlier had spoken of death in connection with the universality of the genus. In a sense, it's the death of the individual member of the species that sort of overcomes the individuality of the species member, but it does not eliminate the species itself. The species is going to be something that maintains itself, even as its individual members are eliminated and removed from the scene. Well, here he points at death being transfigured here in a spiritual way. Right, we have on the way, on one hand, the resurrection, but then we also have the spiritual community living in its own religious manner, a daily death and resurrection. All right, so the religious community, in a way, seems to engage in this activity, this kind of embodying, this connecting between the absolute and actual self-consciousness. Hegel says, you know, here we have spirit knowing itself as spirit. You know, in this religious community, the individuals and participants know themselves as a self that has absolute significance, that is, in a sense, all reality, because the divine, the absolute essence, is just what it is. Just what it is as an individual who is also universal. One knows this, you know, as part of one's religious faith. So what is the what limitation? interpretation is there still that involves some kind of problem that indicates that there's going to be reason for a further development. This is not going to be the end of experience of consciousness. That's going to engender what might be thought of as a further shape, and what may turn out to be the final shape, the shape to end all shapes. Hegel tells us in paragraph 787, here the religious community has not yet reached its real consummation. There's still some kind of estrangement. There's still some kind of discrepancy. It isn't really able to, you could say, validate the certainty it has. What is lacking? I mean, one way Pagel puts it is to say, you know, as he does later on in paragraph 787, he says, this religious community does not have a consciousness about what it is. It does not really have a consciousness of itself, even though it has a kind of self-consciousness in what it's conscious of. But,
the only consciousness of a representation of what it is.
I mean, well, what is it representing? And I think this is an obvious point, but I think it's critical.
Representing itself.
Well, is it representing itself? Is it representing its own activities? Or are its activities about something it's representing? It's different from itself, from what it is actually doing.
It is still addressing the divine.
But I mean, when you say the divine, what does that carry with it? It means it's not conscious of itself. And it's still something, there's still an element of transcendence here, or not the way of putting it, right? The religious community is worshiping, or it's representing, not its own activities, but those of the God that has incarnated itself and resurrected itself. That's the narrative that it's representing. Its activities are concerned with that. It is concerned with something in which it, you know, in a sense, recognizes itself in one respect, but on the other hand, is still distinct from itself. You know, Hegel points out how, okay, there's also a representation of a future reconciliation, right after the last judgment and things of that sort. However one were to fill out such representations, I think you want to ask yourself, well, why is there a basis for them? Why is it that even when religious consciousness comes to the point of construing the divine so that it is an actual human being, that, however, is also the absolute essence, that carries with it something where the self-consciousness of spirit still involves an opposition, or another way of putting it, still involves a consciousness. Or, you know, as Hegel here puts it, you know, all the forms of religious consciousness involve representation. Instead of a conceptual grasp of the object, you might ask, how would a conceptual grasp of the object remove this element of consciousness or this opposition? Or another way of putting it, what the religious community is conscious of is different of is still different in some respect from its consciousness of itself. Even if it has its consciousness of itself through it, what it's conscious of. Because that's how it's been working throughout every form of religion. You have the religious community being conscious of its own, of itself. In being conscious of something it takes to be, you know, the absolute essence. Now the divine becomes removed as much as possible, you might say, by what the content is being equivalent to its own content. At least in the sense of being actual self-consciousness, it is also universal, it is spirit. You know, the divine has spirit. But there's still an element of consciousness here. Well, you know, ask yourself, what is it that retains that element of consciousness? What has to be removed to eliminate that element? I mean, Hegel presents the problem as being a matter of there remains a discrepancy between the consciousness, what the religious community is conscious of, what the religious individual is conscious of, and their consciousness of themselves, or their self-consciousness. They are an individual, they are individuals who are aware of themselves as being an individual who's no less universal, and being in a community with others who are like themselves. They're conscious of themselves and are conscious of themselves in that capacity and being conscious of that which is their true essence. Now, what is it? And their true essence is also conceived of as self-consciousness. So they're, you could say that they are a knowing of themselves, which is a knowing. They're a knowing of knowing, or a consciousness of consciousness, in virtue of having as their object a self-consciousness, or, you know, you might ask, is that a knowing of knowing? Well, I'll leave you this as it stands at the time being, and just give you, you know, some tasks to look at as we move to the final chapter. So on the one hand, you want to think about where this shape is going to move, and why can we think of it as a penultimate shape of religion? I mean, one way of thinking of the penultimate shape of religion is to say, okay, there's no further mode of religious consciousness available. All of them have been exhausted. That would require somehow thinking back of how the different types are differentiated, and seeing, having some principle available for saying that there can't possibly be any other options. The other way is to see how this is going to undergo a transformation that will leave behind what characterizes religious consciousness. Now, as you know, Hegel has been pointing to absolute knowing as being the end of the road for the phenomenology of spirit, or for the science of consciousness. It's going to be the end of the road because somehow or other, it is going to involve a consciousness that arises in such a way that it can no longer distinguish between its object and its relating to the object. Or it no longer has an indeterminate opposition of consciousness. So it has, you know, at least two sides to it. It's going to emerge as a shape of consciousness in a way, but one that is going to undercut not only itself, but the shape of consciousness in general. It's going to undercut itself in a way that will be unlike the way in which every previous shape is undercut, have undercut themselves, in leading to a further shape. This somehow is going to lead to no further shape of consciousness, but to an elimination of the opposition which made, you know, progress from one shape to another possible. So I think you want to ask yourself, when you see how Hegel plots it out, why this would be something that can only occur now once we've gone through what we've gone through, in particular, gone through what occurs in religion, how that really is going to set the stage for the removal of the entire opposition. So as you read on in this final section, you know, think about that. Think about how one gets to absolute knowing from the end of revealed religion. How in a certain sense it begins its life as a kind of opposition, or seems to appear as an opposition of consciousness, or appears to be some kind of shape. But one that bites the dust in a way that brings this whole thing to closure. And in doing so, I'd like you to think about a problem I raised at the very beginning. Namely, did we really have to go through all of this to get to the kind of end that results? I mean, could there have been some kind of shortcut? Could we have just sort of leapt in at this point and been able to take advantage of whatever it is it achieves and push on from there? And in light of that question, keep an eye on how certain retrospective considerations of what went before figure in the discussion of this final shape. Because if retrospective considerations do figure in, that's one way in which this final shape cannot dispense with what went before. So keep an eye on that. So we'll come back then on Thursday at 2:00 to 4:45. Make it to the very end, triumphant, bitter. We'll see. In any event, hopefully a class not to be forgotten. Let's push ahead finally to the very end, and then we can celebrate. Hopefully having finished this path of despair left behind us.